This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And at the bottom of the hour, I will be talking to Christine Newell about her book, The Habit of Grateful. It is a handbook for gratitude, and it's a fascinating book, and she has a very intriguing way to promote gratitude, and I think you will all find it so interesting. It is in a box, and so we will be looking forward to talking to her at the bottom of the hour. But right now, I get to turn to Chad Boudreaux. He is an author who has written a book called Scavenger Hunt. And, you know, many people know where they were on 9/11. And I think Chad knows exactly where he was the night before 9/11. Hi, Chad.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Wow. So it's true that you were hired just on the day before 9/11?
That's right. That's right. I was waiting patiently, or maybe not so patiently, for months after interviewing with the Department of Justice. And the night before the terrorist attacks, I was sitting in my study in Austin, Texas, and got the call probably, I think, 9 o'clock Central Time, so 10 o'clock Eastern Time, obviously. And the next morning, I woke up to drive in to work at my law practice, and that's when I learned of the terrible events of that day.
Whoa, so you sort of were just shoved right into this whole big what happened. And of course, with your situation, you're working now for the Department of Justice at one of the most critical times in the history of the United States.
It really was. I mean, I was 27 years old at the time. I'd been married for a couple of years, only had a Great Dane. Although he was big, he's the only real character in my book, Judge. And we packed all of our things and dumped them off at some barn in East Texas and drove all the way to D.C. and ended up in a very small condominium not far from the Supreme Court, where the world had changed and our world certainly had changed. And it was a very harrowing experience, to be sure.
So you arrived. The Pentagon had been bombed, had been hit, and it must have been really a startling thing to drive into Washington, D.C. on a few days after this happened.
No doubt. I mean, I had been a political science major in college. And by the way, I tell my kids now, do not get a political science degree unless you have to, because I don't think I've ever used that before, but... apologies to any political science professors out there. I've tried to use mine, but I did have wide eyes when it came to D.C. I was mesmerized by it and loved the energy there. But, we were third in East Capitol, which, again, is like a stone's throw from the Capitol itself. The FBI had created a semi-permanent barricade right there in front of our condominium. And it was just every morning you woke up, and there was an energy, there was a little bit of frightfulness, really like an esprit de corps with the city, though, when it came to this mentality of we're not going to let this happen again. But, Patsy, I'll tell you one thing that was very interesting, and that is not too long after 9/11, the fear around the Capitol wasn't really focused on international terrorism or any other kind of terrorism other than the snipers, the D.C. snipers. And I don't know if you recall those two men who were driving around and just randomly committing violence, deadly violence. And I remember walking outside my apartment condominium door and so I could get the Washington Post because you just never knew. That was probably the most frightful time during that period.
So there you are in the Justice Department dealing with, immediately we're looking at terrorism and what we can do to stop it and what's happening in the country, because we didn't know if there were other terrorists around.
No doubt. Every week it seemed like there was another story in the paper. And I know that the week I started, there was, or the week that I showed up on site at Main Justice, there were reports of anthrax being through the vent, the mail room, and through the vents. And so we had to evacuate. The Congress had to evacuate for anthrax scares. It seems like every week there was something new. It was not only preventing future attacks, but it was also addressing victims of the attacks, those who had survived, and family members who had died. My first day on the job was sitting down with those folks and talking about a victims' compensation fund, which ultimately Kenneth Feinberg helped administer and did a fantastic job, and now is a special series on Netflix and called Worth, where Michael Keaton plays Mr. Feinberg, and that was a lot of our time spent soon after I got there.
So now you've written this book, which is based on your experience in Washington, starting, of course, during this time. And you have a main character, Blake Hudson, and as you said, he does have your dog. you brought your dog into the story.
Yeah, and it's funny because Judge's favorite place to hang out was right around the Library of Congress, so it's a little ironic. And I feel like we've memorialized him well. So I'll let the readers figure out what happens to Judge. But he is somewhat of an important character in the book.
Well, he definitely is. And now let's talk a little bit about Blake Hudson and what's going to happen to him. How does he get dragged into all of the events that you're writing about in the book?
Yeah, so Blake is a character that evolved over the writing of the book, and I say that because what I wanted to do was I wanted to take, and to the extent that there was, I'm probably giving this more intentionality than there was at the time, but I wanted to create a character that was somewhat of an amalgamation of a lot of the other folks that I worked with, and he's got a lot of different characteristics that you would see from people working in the department, and he also has kind of a neophyte sense to him because he's new and he's young and he's in a position of a lot of power, and that's not uncommon in D.C. to see this. And what I did with Blake is I created a very complicated and treacherous situation, about as treacherous as you could think of, and I put him in that scene in that theater, and we kind of watched. See how he responds, and he's just a young lawyer that has done pretty well so far, and he just wants to do right by his country and by for his job, and we make that very hard for him to do. to watch him get out of that box is all about the narrative.
So, explain the scavenger hunt, or the title.
Yeah, so the scavenger hunt, really it's about going after the terrorists at the very sense of the word, but then as them, they being the scavengers. But then you find that there are some hidden henchmen behind the scenes that are driving things, and ultimately the hunt is, Blake becomes not, he's no longer the hunter, he's the hunted, and is running for his life, and you're trying to figure out who's after him. So that's really the basis behind the title.
And for you, when you were there, it's Washington, as you said, is such an exciting place, and there is so much happening. And of course, there are all these different aspects of who's doing what and why are they doing it, and who you can trust very much so, I think, in Washington, because people are confused at this point when it happened. Oh, great. Listen to that. Here I am, the host, and I left my phone on. Well, that's that. Well, maybe that was a secret message. You know, you never know. Yeah, and that could
shut you down.
That could be true. Maybe I hit a nerve to somebody. I'm saying that they have secrets in Washington D.C. It's always so funny. I mean, now you know, you do have in Washington, you know, all the time where you have a scene where the people are talking and you don't know who's listening. And, of course, nowadays, they're all listening.
It does feel that way. I'm not sure. You know, we're having a conversation recently just about the Patriot Act and how the politics behind the Patriot Act has evolved over time. And but there is this sense now with all of the technology. Whether you're in D.C. or not, people feel like, you know, their conversations are no longer private. Now, for me, that's okay because I don't really talk about that much important. But I know for others, it can be very disturbing to even think about that. I want to go back to what you said about D.C., though, and it's really a place sometimes where it is hard to trust those around you. I think those of us that have lived there, we certainly have our groups of people that, you know, whom we trust, but it's, you kind of see human depravity on stage sometimes when people are put into that political environment and everybody's competing for power. And in D.C., as you know, it's interesting in Texas, you know, people are always trying to have the biggest house or make the most money. And when you get to D.C., everybody kind of has the same size house, but it's about who has the most power. And so it's a little bit of a different dynamic for me when I moved up there to see what drove people's incentives and things and behaviors.
And who has the best secrets. And, of course, for poor Blake Hudson, some people think he's paranoid. He's saying, people are watching me, people are following me. But he wasn't paranoid.
Know what they say, you know, even though you may be paranoid doesn't mean you're wrong. And in Blake's case, that's certainly true. And he had a lot of things coming at him at one time, and things started not to make sense, and for good reason, it turns out. And so the fun of the book is really about watching him and see how he addresses those challenges with attention.
And of course, it's very relevant because you have different aspects: China, Pakistan, Iran. You know, so we have, it's all real. I mean, we have all these enemies.
Yeah, I think too. You know, what I'd hope to do. Somebody asked me, you know, last week about the book. They said, "What were you trying to say other than the story?" And I said, "Well, the story, first and foremost, is entertainment, and the reader needs to be captivated from page one to the end, or I've failed. And I don't really have any political agenda for this book, but if there is one thing that I think is a subtle undercurrent, and maybe it's not so subtle, is I think Blake Hudson exposes the challenges that we have with all of the things going on in this world. And what you find is, whether you're more leaning towards privacy or more leaning towards national security, some of us fall on that spectrum somewhere. And but oftentimes the pundits and the politicos try to make that a binary situation. You either have to do this or that. And it's not that easy. And I think that Blake in his plight exposes that. It's really not that easy. And so by putting him in these harrowing situations, including all these different countries, I think you get a sense of really what we're up against and how hard it can be to maneuver through the maze.
Well, and it's true. I mean, we really, I like when a book has this underpinning where we have, where, I mean, we're talking about real problems. It, you know, so as you said, you have the story, but you have also this, hopefully people will like take a few minutes and say, yeah, is this happening? Is China doing this? Is Iran doing this? And you know, so it opens people's minds, and I think that's a very important part of a book like this.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I think that it is going to educate many in kind of the different situations. I think those that are in the space, whether they're diplomats or they're other parts of the legal or national security apparatus, they're going to understand kind of what these challenges are. But for the casual reader who just wants to pick up a good book and learn about new characters and get lost for a little while, I think you do come away with this book of like digesting some truths that we have to confront. And I hope I've done that in a way where, you know, liberals and conservatives will both be happy at times and unhappy at times about how the characters act, because that's normally the way it works in the real world.
And the situation in this world today, what we're facing, all of these challenges of trying to understand, you know, we are in many ways playing checkers when they're playing chess, because they have these countries have long-term goals. They see far into the future, and they don't, what's happening today isn't as important to them as what is going to happen, you know, years from now. And we're not, I think as Americans, we don't think that way.
Well, you couldn't have said that better. I really think that we're obviously blessed to be in a country that is, you know, a constitutional republic where democracy is real and underpins pretty much all that we have in our judicial system, at least, in our political system. But China doesn't have that. As much as we love our freedoms and don't want to give them up, they do provide restrictions, and the restrictions are not restrictions that China and others who really think about hegemony over the world, and their history shows that that's their aim, that's not restrictions they have. And you're right. They do have a very long-term game plan, and you can kind of see, even if you're paying attention, see how they're working throughout the world right now to carry that out.
Well, anyone who's ever lived in Iran, and I did live in Iran, knows it's so funny. People don't, most people, you know, are not aware of the difference, really. Although we've gone through the Iraq War and we had all of this, they still don't understand the concept of Shiite and Sunni. They still don't understand they really, each side has a long-term, I mean, they're looking 100 years from now of becoming the dominant power. And it's hard for us to, as Americans, to think that way. We just can't conceive that people can have this long-term game plan and work just zealously to get to that point.
Yeah, it's hard to get that perspective. You're right. I mean, there's many good books that, you know, your readers, or your listeners rather, who care about the issue just mentioned could turn to. I remember reading A History of the Arab Peoples back in the day, and just really getting a better understanding of the Sunni-Shiite conflict, and you do need to kind of understand their perspective if you're going to address the challenges and opportunities
exactly
that we have as a country.
And meanwhile, Blake Hudson has a lot of challenges in both his world, his work world, which is not always easy, because he has to deal with a lot of not just outside of the world, you know, politics, but inside, just office kind of politics that he has to deal with people.
Well, and he's also a single 20-something young lawyer who actually has a love interest too, and so he's got that to deal with. But yeah, the office politics are acute, and really, I think, you know, I looking back on the the book, and particularly the dialogue in the book. I think most of the rich dialogue comes between the banter in the office, and that was of all the many fun times I had writing certain parts of the book. That was a highlight for me, is kind of reliving some of those conversations that I had as a lawyer there at Main Justice. And those aren't my conversations and those aren't my people, but, you know, it's reminiscent of what I saw.
And so did you, in your job, did you get to travel quite a bit or not?
I did. I spent some time at DOJ. We spent a lot of time going up to New York for obvious reasons after 9/11, and that was a focal point. But my main travel happened when I moved to be the Deputy Chief of Staff for the Department of Homeland Security right after that. And we flew to a lot of really interesting places and met very interesting people. And of all the travel that I did, that's probably been the highlight, actually, not only of my career, but also just of my life, really.
And, of course, you've drawn a lot of that into the book. And, of course, I'm glad you mentioned dialogue, because you do write really great dialogue.
Well, I appreciate that. As a trial lawyer, I think my passion growing up as a young lawyer was trial work. And as litigators and trial lawyers, I think we watch people very closely and we listen very intently, because, you know, when we have a case, whether we're on the plaintiff's side or the defense side, on the prosecution side or the defense side, we know that a lot of times we're going to have one very powerful judge, or maybe three on the appellate side, but really 12 jurors. And they come from all different walks of life, and they look different than one another, and they have different experiences. And if you don't know kind of what's on their mind, you're going to lose. And so I think just paying attention to what people say, you learn dialogue, and you learn a dialogue that's real.
Well, I think you had fun writing this book. Just quickly, you know, my listeners are always interested in what books formed you. What books had the greatest impact, books that you read?
Yeah, so I think from a pure intelligence and spy kind of novel side, it was Robert Ludlum. Robert Ludlum, for sure. I also grew up a Tom Clancy fan. I don't have his detail, but I like the way he told stories. Interestingly enough, the characters that I hope to build, the character development, I learned a lot from Stephen King, and I really liked his book on writing as a guide. And again, you heard me mention it earlier, but one of the things that I used to roll my eyes at when I read on writing was he said your characters are going to change and surprise you, and they're going to take on lives of their own. And I was kind of thinking that's hokey, you know, pie in the sky kind of archy stuff. But then when I started writing, that actually happened. And the outlines that I would do, I'd do kind of a skeletal outline to begin. My character started turning the outline on its head. And so I'm a true believer now in that concept.
Well, that's why I call this show Joy on Paper, because it is such a joy when you're writing, when at one point the characters start taking over. And it is so much fun.
Yeah, and then you start getting mad at your characters, and they take on lives of their own. I just had that happen a few weeks ago. I'm mad at my new protagonist.
I was going to say.
That tells you what kind of shape I'm in.
Well, I was going to say, of course, this is your first book, right?
Yeah.
Your first one.
Yeah.
And I knew, of course, the minute I finished it, I said, well, he's already writing the second book. I mean, he's just found that joy on paper. So I knew that you were not going to stop, right?
We're going to keep going.
Yeah.
And until someone tells us to stop.
Well,
so we've got one in the editor right now, and then I've researched a new one over the break. So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
That's what I love. That's what I love when writers find that joy on paper. It grabs you, and then the readers find that joy on paper when they read your book. So it's it's all together. It's a lot of fun. And I think you've done a great job with this book. And I hope that people will get it. And your name is Chad Boudreau. I love that. And the name of the book is Scavenger Hunt. And do you have a website you want people to go to?
I do. It's just chadboudreau.com.
Okay.
So Chadboudreaux.
Yes, spelled beautifully the French way. And it is When Justice is Blind, Scavengers Do the Hunting. And Chad, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you. And as soon as you have the next release date, you'll be back here, right?
Thank you so much. I appreciate that, and definitely will be back.
Okay. Keep writing. Have a lot of fun. And, yeah, it's nice to argue with your characters. Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
He's cute. Isn't he cute? Okay. We're going to have a book buzz from Devon Miller and a few commercials, and then I'm going to be back, and we're going to talk about gratitude. And it's a really wonderful book by Christine Newell.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. A lively celebration of friendship and music is here for readers to enjoy. The Animal Song, written and illustrated by Jaunty Howley, is here. A crocodile, a big brown bear, and a weasel form a traveling band and play for the other animals in the woods. But when winter comes, the animals in the woods head to bed, leaving the traveling band to find a new audience to hear their sound. Jaunty first sketched the main characters back in 2019. While waiting to hear if his story would get published, he made models of the characters from the story to calm his nerves. Having a lot of fun making them, the book eventually got published. While being a story, The Animal Song is also, well, a song, with original music composed by the author and illustrator himself, Jaunty Howley. Perhaps when you read The Animal Song, maybe you'll also sing along. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. Christine Newell has written a fantastic book. It is called The Habit of Grateful, a handbook for gratitude. I'm so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper, Christine.
Thank you so much for having me, Patsy. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I love this book, and I love one of the things that you've done with this book. You've come out with a very nice marketing idea because, of course, that's what you are. You are great at marketing. Please tell everybody what you do, because you have a very big executive position.
I do. I'm very blessed to be the Senior Vice President for Premier Sotheby's International Realty, a very large luxury real estate company. And that's my exciting day job. I get to work with a ton of incredible people and in the world of real estate.
You are at the top. You are with the best company in the world, I think. It's fantastic what you made, this wonderful career for yourself. And it all comes from, really, you started at the bottom here, and mm-hmm. not just the bottom of career-wise, but you were at the bottom. This is a fascinating story, and one that I think, you know, at the beginning of the year in January, I always like to bring to my listeners inspiring stories that maybe, you know, they make these resolutions at the first of the month, and then by the middle of the month they're like, they didn't do it, so I'm not, why am I trying, right? And I thought this was such perfect timing to have you here at the end of January. And people, listen to Christine, because she went through a lot and she overcame so much, so you can do it too. You don't have to, you know, just because you didn't start on the 1st of January, the 31st of January is just as good to start, correct?
Absolutely. And the thing with gratitude is there's you know, you can start today using gratitude as a habit. And, you know, in the book, it was so exciting for me to study the science of gratitude, but also interview others that have used gratitude as a habit, I really credit that, Patsy, with changing my life. And for me, I think rock bottom for me was what I describe as the butter moment.
I love that story. You have to tell it I was so impressed with your writing in general, because not every inspirational book is written as if it could also be a novel, because you write so beautifully. And
thank you.
So do you want to tell this story?
Absolutely, and thank you for that compliment. That's so kind of you. Yeah, so the butter story was I was newly divorced with three little kids, was selling real estate during the financial crash of 2008, for those of us that remember that, kind of 2009.
I remember it.
Mm-hmm, a lot of us do. And I had a moment where my ex-husband had moved out, and, you know, financially I was having a tough time, but I don't think I really understood how bad it was getting, maybe living in a little bit of denial. And I'll never forget, I went to make dinner for the kids and just not find anything to make for dinner. The fridge was bare, the freezer was bare, my cupboards were bare, and I kept, you know, trying to put together, well, can I do eggs, can I do some type of pasta, and I kept, you know, I didn't have butter. And it kind of hit me over the head, I didn't have butter. I collapsed on the floor. And it wasn't just about that one moment, obviously. It was the culmination of going through a messy divorce and having three kids and the market collapsing, and every single thing in my life was going wrong. Collapsed on the floor, crying, sobbing, and my three children kind of appeared above me and said, Mom, it's going to be okay. They called my parents, and that was kind of the bottom. I I talk about this because I feel, when you hit bottom, you can only go up, right? So that's kind of the good thing about hitting bottom. Sometimes you can only go up from there. And I ended up rebuilding my life. I mean, it took some time, but, you know, that was the butter moment. And so I do talk about it in the book.
Well, and you write about it beautifully. How old were the kids at that time?
Oh, gosh. So my daughter is about 4. My other son probably 7, and then probably 11 were their ages at that.
And so there they are looking at mom on the floor like, butter. She's all about butter at the moment. But it's so such a, I think, a heart-wrenching moment, and also then heartwarming to know that you had these wonderful kids who are just there for you. And at that point when you realize that you had to be there for them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I think when I first started writing about it, it was highly emotional because I think for a long time I blocked out a lot of this. You know, it's like, who wants to talk about the fact that they couldn't, you know, make a meal for their kids? I think as a mother, that's probably my deepest and darkest fear. Like, how could I not provide for my children in that moment? But I think it's powerful because the more I've shared the story, I've heard from so many people that also, you know, had hardship. And what I've also learned is it's nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, the most successful people in the world, Oprah, Elon Musk, you know, it goes on, they struggled and they failed a lot. And, you know, failure's okay. It makes us smarter and stronger.
So there you are at really the rock bottom, the butter bottom, and you've got to claw your way up. And it wasn't easy, but you did have help. And you did, as you said, you found people who were there for you and people to whom you are grateful.
100%. And here's the thing about life. You don't need 100 friends. You just need a few, maybe even one. I was lucky enough to have a beautiful friend in my life, Mary Deneen, and she believed in me. She lent me strength. She was there for me. I also have incredible family, and I leaned on them pretty heavy. And immediately, you know, they told me, you can do this. You know, you're strong. You're smart. You got this. You can do it. I can't tell you how much those words mean to me. They gave me, like, artificial confidence. And I was so grateful for my friends in that moment. And in fact, my friend Mary and I, we wrote notes, letters back then. It was more handwritten notes than emails and texts. We wrote letters back and forth. And I would tell her how much she meant to me and how much I appreciated her. So she was definitely a big part of that journey.
So what did you discover in your, as you said, you did some research into the attitude of gratitude?
Absolutely. And I think sometimes, you know, when you say the word gratitude, look, it's a buzzword. So people hear that. Some people roll their eyes, you know. But in fact, you know, the gratitude I'm referring to is a habit of gratitude. So it's not an occasional thank you note. It's not Thanksgiving. I mean, those things are cool. But a habit of grateful means that you consciously practice gratitude every single day. And in the book, I have 4 habits in which to do that. But what's fascinating is there's so much research that's fairly newer, so much research that talks about how the more you practice gratitude as a habit, there are physical benefits, like a stronger immune system, not as much aches and pains, you sleep better, there are psychological benefits, so you have higher positive emotions, you're more alert, you have better relationships, more, you know, less loneliness and isolation. So in total, I mean, in the research path is really fun. I mean, I'm not a scientist for sure. However, the more I dug into this, I mean, there are neuroimaging that's been done that show different parts of your brain respond to a habit of gratitude. And the other cool thing is I've met so many people, and I talk about them in the book, it's like they have this superpower. Their eyes kind of sparkle. You know, they're just always in a pretty good mood. When you meet them, you just want to talk to them. These are people that are practicing a habit of gratitude. So the science was fascinating, and I have noticed since I've been, you know, practicing gratitude as a habit for quite some time, I have a lot of these benefits. You know, I really do. My mood is pretty even. So I think this is kind of fascinating, and I didn't know all this until I went on this journey of writing this book.
So you talk about the four attitudes to gratitude. How do you explain that?
Absolutely. So four habits of gratitude. So the first one is every single day waking up and asking yourself, what am I grateful for today? Now, I do this every morning as soon as I kind of wake up, come to consciousness. I don't just grab my phone, turn on the light. I literally lay there, and it could be a few minutes, and I talk to myself a little bit, and I name off what I'm grateful for in that moment. And then I think about my day ahead, and I'm very grateful every single day I'm alive. Every single day I wake up, I say, I am alive, and I am grateful to be here. Today is a gift. And then I name off what I'm really grateful for. Now, some people wake up and write this in a journal. Some people say it out loud. You can really do what works for you. But the point is, every morning, do your daily gratitude. So that's habit number one. Do you want me to keep going through them?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Habit number two is be the sunshine. And that just means to look for opportunities throughout your day to use gratitude. And it's as simple as just saying to people as you're talking to them that you appreciate them. So when I'm having a conversation with someone, I frequently say, I appreciate you. I say it verbally. I say it in a text. I put it in an email. It's really, you know, even if I'm buying something at CVS, when I'm done paying, I always look at the cashier and I say, thank you so much. I really appreciate you. Thank you. What I found, Cassie, is that our biggest desire for us as humans is to feel like we matter. So when we're appreciating someone, we're really telling them that we're grateful for them and that they matter. So that's a really fun one, and it feels good, and it's like just sprinkling sunshine everywhere you go. Habit number three is writing notes of gratitude, and that's easy. You know, just get into the habit of writing handwritten notes of gratitude and sending them in the mail. This is something I've done professionally, and in fact, even like President Bush was a big proponent of this. There are other people in history, the more you dig into this, that wrote notes of gratitude. And they, and not only does the person that receive it, they feel great, but when you write a note, those same kind of dopamine and serotonin chemicals in your brain, we talked about the brain matter, that is working when you just write a note of gratitude. And in the book, I have a whole chapter of how to write notes, who to write them to. I have writing prompts just to make it super easy. Don't overcomplicate it. Just try to even do one a week. And then the last habit is commit. And, you know, it's taking your vitamin G, right? This is your gratitude pill. So really commit to gratitude. Make it a morning habit. Make it an evening habit. Track your progress. Sign a gratitude contract. Tell others, hey, I'm committing to gratitude. I'm living a habit of grateful. And so those are kind of the four habits. Pretty simple.
And it is so rewarding, because if you do it, as you said, there are changes in your brain, in your entire emotional life, that it changes when you're grateful.
Absolutely. It's interesting. When you're always thinking about what you don't have, you'll find you never have enough. But when you really focus on what you're grateful for, suddenly you're rich. You have abundance. You have more than enough.
Well, you know, it was funny. I was thinking, as I'm been thinking about your book and about gratitude, and I'm looking back on my childhood, which I had an absolutely wonderful childhood. I was so blessed. It was such a wonderful childhood. And I was grateful for so many things, but I was grateful the other day when I went to the store and I went to buy an orange. And, now, you know, nowadays things are expensive. And I picked up this orange, and it was $1.69 for an orange in Florida. And I'm thinking, this is crazy. But it reminded me of something that was absolutely glorious in my childhood. When I was a child in northern Michigan, we didn't have oranges very often. But once a year, my uncle, who lived in Florida, would send us a wooden crate of oranges. And I remember how we would peel the orange. We would sit in the sunshine, right in the sunshine by a window where it's snow outside, and we'd open that orange. And you know how that there's a sort of a mist that comes out of an orange when it's you're doing it in the sunshine. And I'm so grateful for that memory. It's like it is such a beautiful memory. And that grateful for an orange.
Oh, that is just beautiful. What a gorgeous memory, and just the simplicity. And that's the cool thing about gratitude. Something as beautiful as that orange and that mist, I can just see it. You know, I can smell it. I mean, that is just beautiful. gosh, what a beautiful memory.
And that's why it's important that when we have children, as you do, that we make sure that we give them these moments to be grateful for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think also, you know, I ended up just, you know, interviewing some others that had some of the most difficult life experiences I could ever imagine. And I do interview them because, you know, I've met a few people, for instance, Melissa Wandahl, who lost her husband in a car crash. And if you meet Melissa, I mean, she just sparkles. And she's so grateful for everything around her and her daughter and her friends, and she has a beautiful foundation. And I wanted to ask her, you know, how did you get through and how do you keep going? And I think gratitude helps people when they're going through trauma as well. It's like a life raft, you know? And so I think all of a sudden basic things that we, you know, take for granted, when you lose something like that, immediately you have gratitude, you know, and so it's kind of interesting how it works even for times of trauma, and it kind of gets people through.
Now, you have a very interesting, system for helping people to be grateful. Tell us about your box of gratitude.
Oh, thank you. So, yeah, I came up with the box of gratitude. If someone wants to get started just writing a note of gratitude, and you know, if you don't know how to do it, it's just a little kit. It's $10, and it comes with the instructions, 6 beautiful note cards, and also a little tracking sheet. So I found, you know, again, if you're new to writing a note of gratitude, it's an easy way to get started. People have told me the writing prompts help, you know, because sometimes you think, oh, I'm going to write a note to someone. What do I say? And I think having those prompts, I mean, I've taken writing classes my whole life, and I can't tell you how prompts, you know, write. So sharing the writing prompts in the box, I just think it's a fun little kit. So, thanks for shouting those out, Kathy.
Well, I wanted to, because I want people to go to your website, which is, just tell people.
Absolutely. So guidetogratitude.com or boxofgratitude.com.
And they can go there. As you said, it's $10, and you can buy it for yourself or you can send it as a gift. And
absolutely,
I think that is such a clever idea, and I hope that people will go to your website and order that, because you have to put it into action. As you said, you can think about being grateful, but when you actually do something, and I do like the idea of writing it down, because there is a difference when you write something by hand that is completely different than texting it. And it is something real and something that people can hold in their hands and people will save. And that's exactly what happens when you get a card from somebody that says something nice to you. People keep it. I mean, I've got things that people wrote to me, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and I still have them. Because they do reinforce that somebody cared about you at some point in life.
Absolutely. And I have friends that will keep, if they do get a note from someone, they put it in a box and they call it like their bad day box. So if they're having a bad day, they take out their little box and they read all the little notes people have written to them over the years. I have heard from people when I've sent a note, people have said, oh my gosh, I got your note and you made my day. I was having such a bad day and I got your note and it meant so much. It's a bit of a lost art. I agree with you. Sending a note these days, though, when everything is electric, you know, you stand out and it's so thoughtful. It's almost like giving a gift. If you just write someone a little handwritten note and tell them why you're grateful for them, tell them why you appreciate them, you know, it's incredible. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Well, I thought it was just a brilliant idea, actually. You know, of course, that comes from your years of experience now as being a, first, I think you were a top seller, you know, with Sotheby's, and now you're in a leadership role of really directing all of the agents and adopting the same attitude with them, being grateful mm-hmm. to all the people who work with you. And it's not so much that they work for you, they work with you.
Absolutely. I like to say I work for them.
Exactly. Well, Christine, I think the book is wonderful. And as I said, your writing is just superb. I teared up when I read that butter story, and I thought, oh, well, when somebody writes a nonfiction book and the writing is so good that it makes you cry, I thought, whoa, this is one great writer.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much. That's so kind of you. I appreciate that.
Well, I hope that in between everything else you're doing with your company and with this book, which I think will get you, you know, as you are already a great public speaker, but now you have a real tool here to go around and talking about gratitude and encouraging people to do good things in their life and to find the joy, actually, of living, which is all part of something that we have to be grateful for. So, Christine, again, thank you for being on Joy on Paper today. And I'm just telling everybody, get this book and get the box. As you said, it's just $10, and it's will make a wonderful gift. And it's coming up to Valentine's Day, people. And if you want to send a Valentine to somebody, send this box for $10. You can't beat it. It's absolutely a wonderful gift.
Oh, thank you so much, Patsy. I really appreciate you, and Joy on Paper is incredible. Thank you so much for sharing this message of gratitude, and I appreciate you.
Okay. Well, bye-bye now. And I have a feeling, Christine, I have a feeling maybe there's a novel in you yet, you know? I think it's there. When you write as well as you do, and you have found the joy on paper, I think you'll be back.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. Oh, wow. Very, very nice book. Very nice book, and very, you know, we do have so much to be grateful for. This world is crazy. Sometimes somebody told me the other day, she said, you know, everything falling apart. I said, well, yeah, but, you know, things have been falling apart for years. Well, we keep going. And so to find this attitude of gratitude and find this habit with Christine Newell and get her book, The Habit of Gratitude, a handbook for gratitude. It's a habit of grateful. And then we'll have the habit of gratitude. Everybody, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. And if you're very, very lucky to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry, because I want to see Aunt Ibby on the screen. And that is from her Witch City Mystery series. And anyway, everybody, say something nice to somebody. Be grateful. And I am very, very grateful for Big Ed in the control room, because he is so good to me. And he is saluting me. And he always salutes me, which means I am a general. Oh boy. I would have been such a great general. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
It's time for the Tuesday edition of Canada Calling, the news from home for vacationing Canadians. Prior Smith speaking from Toronto. Thanks for joining us. As mentioned yesterday, we didn't have much of a winter here in southern Ontario until last week. We've had two major snowfalls since, and now the outlook for the rest of this week can be summed up in one word: frigid. In fact, extreme cold weather warnings have been issued for Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, and the far north through to the end of this